Hello everyone, and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And today we're going to be talking about magic and medicine in ancient Egypt. This is actually part of a longer multi-part series of podcasts that's focusing on daily life in ancient Egypt. And specifically, we're looking at a lot of these daily topics through the lens of a village named Deir el-Medina. This episode isn't going to focus as much on that village, but it is going to have a lot of information from there, simply because that's the best place that we have as a source for daily life. I don't want to go too much into it because it's something we've already talked about in previous podcasts. So let's just jump right into magic and medicine, with the caveat being that if you want a little bit more information about how we know some of this daily life material, where we're getting it from, go back and listen to the three previous podcasts where we actually discuss the village, some of its inhabitants, as well as the economy. For those of you who are regular listeners, you know the way my podcasts work. I often do topic-based as opposed to just a strict narrative. So many of these topics all, for me, fit within the broader concept of daily life in ancient Egypt. And the reason that I link magic and medicine together is because, as we'll see today, for the ancient Egyptians, they really were considered to be part of the same system. These were two things that could be used independently, but often were used together. Now, magic in ancient Egypt has a long, long history. We have amulets and other objects going back to the 4th millennium before the Common Era that already show that they're having some sort of a sense of magic and what these magical items are. Now, this is something that we often joke about, especially with the field of anthropology and the idea that whenever we come across something that we don't know what it is, we can't discern its function, it must be ritual. But there are clearly things that are meant to be ritual. And the textual evidence for some of these magical ideas already starts then in the 3rd millennium. So we have a long, long history, really, of about 4,500 years if we go from those early appearance of amulets to about the 5th century AD, when we start to have the closing of all the Egyptian temples. And that's really where we would say, you know, at this point, Egyptian religion, in the sense of an official religion, we're kind of getting rid of, simply because all of a sudden the Roman Empire is becoming Catholic. We're really shutting down the pagan religions. No doubt individuals are practicing folk medicine. And in fact, many different objects and beliefs and even superstitions that we can see today in Egypt come back from ideas going all the way back. People, you know, people having concepts about the evil eye and other things like that. Now, one of the interesting things about ancient Egyptian magic is we're going to parse it in a lot of different ways, even though these weren't necessarily the ways that the Egyptians themselves would have parsed it. So, for instance, we're going to talk today largely about magic in daily life. But there was, of course, magic in different spheres. We had funerary magic. We have temple magic. So these are different areas where the Egyptians had specifically tailored spells. Now, funerary magic, the magic, say, found within the Book of the Dead, funerary spells, the coffin texts, the pyramid texts, those are by far the most common and the most studied, largely because that's where we have the most evidence. But all three of these categories are interrelated with one another and operate off similar ideas and principles. And the main principle is what in ancient Egyptian we call heka. Heka is the ancient Egyptian word for magic. It can be personified as a god, but we also see that this is a force used by the primordial creator gods themselves. This was a force that was associated with the soul or the ba of the sun god. It was something that all supernatural beings and Egyptian kings and the dead and demons all had access to and could possess. And what's really interesting is that it's completely neutral in meaning. It can be used for destructive power. It can be used for protective power. It can be used to try to produce something. it can be used by evildoers, and we have tales that talk about evil magicians and foreigners using Heka, or it's something that is used by priests and by deities meant to help with creation. So it really, for the ancient Egyptians, is simply a magical force. And in fact, one text tells us that this is a magical force given to mankind. The instruction for Mary Ka Ray says that he makes Heka to ward off the blow of fate. And this is a text that is an instruction text for a king, and the context seems to show that magic was something that the kings could use, and perhaps others could use, in order to protect themselves from objects and enemies and diseases and simply things that they couldn't control. And that's really what magic is about. And we'll get more into the psychology a little bit later. It's not, even though it's something everyone would use, it's not something that in theory was meant for everyone. As I mentioned in the beginning, we have temple magic and specific magic in books. We actually have texts that say it's a bad thing when those hidden books of magic are stolen. It's an interesting translation, but one of those texts from the Admonitions of Ipuwer talks about incantations being made rough because they're repeated so much. And we do have ritual specialists. We have a specific caste of priests called the Hieri Hebet, or those who are under the lector scroll or the festival scroll. Sometimes you'll see these individuals in translations, they'll call lector priests. And these seem to be ritual specialists who worked in temple libraries. And in these temple libraries, which the Egyptian word is great, they're called Per Ankh, which is the house of life. These individuals work with spells, they keep the festival rituals, and they develop a reputation for magic. And in fact, we have many tales within ancient Egypt that talk about these great magicians coming and doing different acts, or sometimes more like entertainment, sometimes they're actually going in search of things. We've talked about these in tangential relations on a couple of the podcasts. So what type of magics are they practicing? Well, we talked about three different areas of magic in terms of the funerary, the temple, and the daily life. But we can break the magic practiced in those three areas down into four types of magic. We have productive magic, which is actually meant to produce something. Destructive magic, which is meant to destroy something. Apotropaic or protective magic. And then curative magic, magic that's used to help cure a disease or something like that. Now, a great way of looking at this is destructive magic. Think voodoo. Think about, I'm going to do a magical spell on, say, this doll. I'm going to pierce it. I'm perhaps going to burn it. The ancient Egyptians actually did these types of magics, and it was thought that by affecting that image, you had the power to affect that. And this gets into what we call magical causality, or what is actually enabling the magic to work. So hopefully this isn't a little bit too dry and a little bit too intellectual, but I do think it's worth about talking about these theories of causalities for just a brief moment. So one way we have is the idea of homeopathic medicine. Now that isn't really from the way we think about it when we think of modern homeopathic medicine. This gets exactly to that principle I was just talking about of like affecting like, right? From that root homo, meaning the same. So that if you have an object or even someone's name, if I write your name on, say, a plate and I smash that plate, I'm symbolically and in a magical way smashing you. And that this done in the proper context with the proper associated rituals would have the ability to affect you and to damage you. And in fact, the ancient Egyptians did exactly that. We have execration texts, as we call them, And these were done by ordinary individuals, and they were also done at the state level. And the way we know that is because we actually have some of the remnants of these offerings found in necropolis. And there seems to be the idea somehow that the necropolis may have been a place where these objects could be safely stored after their ritual use or something like that. For whilst, if that wasn't the case, would we see them buried there? But we see within that messages of destruction aimed not only at some local individuals, but also at the rulers and viziers and important individuals from foreign lands that clearly the local Egyptian magical practitioners wouldn't have had knowledge of unless they somehow had state backing and state information. Another type of way that it was thought magic could affect something was that magic could be contagious. This is something we also see pretty commonly depicted in the media, where perhaps by taking a lock of someone's hair or by having an object that they used to own, that somehow that formed a link with them, and the magic that you do on that object could be contagious and could then go on to affect them. We have another idea, which is called persuasive analogy. This one is a little bit interesting. It's pretty unique. Unique in that it's something that we don't see that much of in our modern day society or zeitgeist. And this is that idea of what I would term a divine threat, is a way we often see this used. So for instance, my son is Horus. And if he isn't cured of this ailment, if he isn't cured of this situation, well, that's going to be like Horus isn't cured of that situation. And if Horus isn't cured, well, now we've got big problems, because Horus is a major important figure. He's represented with the king. He's a god of the sky. So we need to have Horus healed. So if you gods out there know what's good for you, I'm appealing to you not to heal my son, but to heal one of your own. And it's in your best interest to do that. That's how persuasive analogy works. And then finally, what we see the most of is what we would call performative language. And that's simply by performing an act, by doing something in a certain way, you're giving it the power to come into being. So whenever we look at tombs, we'll see lists of different offerings: beer, bread, wine, meat. And oftentimes, that's accompanied by a ritual formula. And that formula is saying, give a voice offering, what's called a peret heru in Egyptian, a sending forth or an emerging of your voice. And what it was thought that was, by saying this list, for instance, 100 loaves of bread, 1,000 jars of beer, 1,000 jars of wine, to the Ka of Ramses, that just by saying that, that performative language and that performative action makes it possible, magically, for those objects to then appear and be used by, in this case, the Ka of Ramses. So that's by far probably the most common type of magical principle that they're working off of here. And largely this is because the cause of magic is to make the human condition better. It's a psychological comfort. And this is something that I think often gets overlooked when talking about magic. Individuals looking at magic in the ancient world think, man, these people must have been really stupid. Why are they buying into this principle? Why are they doing these rituals? It's clear that they don't work. It's clear that by saying this incantation, this object's not appearing. Well, it's not as simple as that. And the reason it's not as simple is because the Egyptians actually were psychologically contented with magic. Magic can give you a peace of mind. there was a great scholar named Malinowski, and he studied magic. And what he said was, magic is ritualized optimism. So what exactly do I mean by this, or how exactly is this working? Well, you know, let's say me as Eric, I have a fancy for a young lady, and I want to get into a relationship with her. I might go see the local magician, and I might talk to that magician and want to get a love charm, let's say. And I'm hoping that this is going to help me to maybe be more attractive to her. So what are the possible outcomes? Well, on the one hand, let's say that it works and she's attracted to me, we have a relationship, and everybody's happy. On the other hand, let's say it doesn't work. Well, I can always, in my head, say, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, but there must be something wrong with the spell that that magician did. There's no reason that I shouldn't be attractive to her. There's no reason that this magical spell shouldn't have worked, and she should be in love with me now. But let's get into a little modern psychology. You'll often hear, especially in the terms of dating, that, you know, individuals need to be confident, that by having a bit of bravado, that does make you more attractive. So perhaps in our love spell scenario, me having the extra confidence of a love spell might give me a little bit more swagger. It actually might make me a little bit more confident and help boost my chances. And that's the way that magic works. Magic looks for a tangible cause and a practical solution to a problem. Another way of thinking about this is, and I believe this comes from Frazier, another great anthropologist and scholar who studied magic, is that magic begins where your rational knowledge leaves off. So let's say, and this gets into the area of medicine, let's say you have a broken arm. Well, many of us know that a broken arm needs to be set. Now, we might not exactly know how to do it. We've seen it on TV. They straighten the bone. They attach a splint to it. That's something that they could do in the ancient world. No doubt, not as well as we can today. They didn't have x-rays. They couldn't put screws in. But they could see a tangible problem and a tangible solution. But what do you do for something like an infection? For the ancient Egyptians, this infection could be caused by the wrath of a god. It could be caused by an evil spirit. It could even be caused by the evil magical intentions of some other magical practitioner. You really don't know. So magic, then, is a way to try to address that. It's a way to try to have some sort of control over life's circumstances. Because otherwise, the world is a very scary place. If we say, I live in Los Angeles. So let's say I was dependent upon fishing for my food and for the food of my family. You know, we'll go back and say we're living here a couple thousand years ago. Well, there are things I can control and things that I know. I might know that certain fish like certain type of food. I might know that certain fish inhabit certain areas at certain times of year. And I'll go out into my boat and I'll go and try to fish for those fish. And I know the bait to use. I know how to make hooks. I know how to get them in. I maybe have netting. I have practical skills I can use. But I've got no way of defending against the attentions of, say, a great white shark. Or if while I'm out there, all of a sudden a storm comes in. Those are all things I have absolutely no control over. And it can make life very scary. But let's say I was taught a charm by my grandfather, who was a fisherman, because my whole family is fishermen. And he lived to a ripe old age and died in his bed. And it's a charm that I say, for instance, as I go out into the sea, I shall be fine and healthy. No one shall hurt me. No evil shall come to me. Me and my crew shall be safe forever. and I maybe do a little manipulation of an object. I maybe have an amulet that goes with it, but I say something that can be that simple. Well, that gives me some sort of psychological comfort going out on that boat. And as we all know, storms coming out of nowhere, say great white sharks, those type of things are going to be relatively uncommon occurrences. So if I say this charm and do this ritual, odds are it's going to have a perfect track record. Now, let's say one day I do get eaten by a shark. Well, other individuals who maybe know that charm can say, oh, well, maybe he didn't say it that day. Maybe he said it wrong. And they're still going to get comfort in it because this is something that has worked for generations, that's been passed down. And that's why magic is important. For the ancient Egyptians, magic can be seen a lot like prayer. Egyptian religion was not a religion that had a need for repentance or redemption or salvation or piety. Certainly there were ideas that you should be a good person and could be punished for not being it. But it wasn't as though you repented for a sin and were hoping to then be absolved of it. That's not how magic works. Again, this is Heka. This is a primordial force that you're marshaling and you have access to. And in fact, if it was a juxtaposition for us, we would consider magic to somewhat be sacrilegious by the terms of many of the Western religions. As I mentioned before with the example of the persuasive analogy where you're attempting to get a god on your side by making an analogy to whoever the victim is of whatever crime or magic or disease or whatever's going on, you equate them with a god so the other gods will hear it. Well, to do that, you're really making yourself a partner to the gods and you're attempting to subject the gods to your will. You're very much manipulating and interfering with the natural course of events. This is much different than accepting the god's superior position and supplicating to them from a humble position. You're not just attempting to maintain the status quo. You're not satisfying the god through prayer. You're really trying to make the god work for you. So we can in many ways see that as from our perspective sacrilegious. But again, the Egyptians tell us through their texts that this was created by the creator god, as I mentioned before, to ward off the blow of fate. So in a way, even the gods need Heka and magic to prevent and overcome negative circumstances. So while we discussed certain individuals like the Hiriheb or the lector priests being specifically associated with magic, and we talked about the gods being associated with magic, we see that in ancient Egypt, everyone is practicing magic. The king, priests, and non-priestly persons. So it really does to be something that involves the entire country. And it's something that individuals may or may not have a greater familiarity or a greater expertise with certain aspects of magic. So we already mentioned these Hiriheb, right? The lector priests. And I mentioned how they work in the House of Life, the temple library, and that they, because of their work there, have a familiarity with magical texts. Well, these individuals also have reputations as dream interpreters. So these seem to be really a specialized class, probably not the people involved in daily rituals, but really more specialized rituals. And individuals who would allow you to hire them out for their services. And of course, because they had this secret knowledge, they also were able to use that with medicine as well. They were able to practice what we would call medicine today. The evidence that we see for practicing medicine, as I mentioned at the very beginning, comes from these three different areas: funerary, temple, and daily life. So it's covering a variety of objects, tomb walls, coffins, papyrus rolls, pot sherds, furniture, amulets, statues. We have evidence of magic on all sorts of different objects. And we see that for the Egyptian objects, they did have a word for actually spells. We see them referred to in two different ways. One is Ahu, which is literally the things which are effective. That's something we'll often translate as spells. They also, we see magic referred to as the art of the mouth. And this, again, has to do with that idea that so many spells are associated with performative action, performative ritual, and likely need to be sung or chanted. And pronunciation, we can imagine, is very, very important for these rituals. For any Army of Darkness fans, the great Klaatu Varata Nikto, you know, when Ash goes in the cemetery and he reads what's supposed to be this Latin phrase that makes it safe for him to take the Necronomicon, and he messes it up and it unleashes this army of the dead. That's the type of thing we're talking about. And it's made much more challenging in ancient Egypt in a way because, as we mentioned, we have a 4,500-year history. So if you've got a spell that's a couple thousand years old, well, anybody who remembers taking Shakespeare in high school, let alone Chaucer or Milton or, God, if we go all the way back to, say, Beowulf in Middle English, I mean, those Old English, those are things that we really today need to read with a translation. So imagine for them going 1,000 years more than that, 2,000 years more than that, 3,000 years more than that. We can see how it would take a specialist to really be able to know the pronunciation. And as you would imagine, some of these texts are great because we actually see cheat sheets. They'll write little notes in between, the same way that we would today write notes on the margins that we're studying. And they even have rubrics. They'll even have sections that instead of writing them, say, in black ink, they'll write it in red. Much like a highlighter, letting them know, oh, this is a new title, or, oh, this section needs to be read. So we can tell that they were challenged by some of these aspects too, and for them it really was a science. There was no attempt by them to preserve these materials. And this is why the funerary is the most common that we have, because most of these objects are only surviving if they're buried as part of a ritual. Luckily, the ancient Egyptians did think that you could take objects with you. So we, in fact, have had magicians bury what we might think of as a magical toolkit or a magician's kit with them. So we do see that some individuals bury daily life magical texts and things in their burial. And that helps us to be able to decipher a little bit how some of these things are being used. Now, I already mentioned execration rituals a little bit, and that was where I talked about taking a plate and writing somebody's name on it, say, and smashing it. But that idea that we have of a voodoo doll, well, that actually is very much something that we do have in ancient Egypt. We have texts, for instance, one from the Book of Overthrowing Apophis that tells us how to make a wax figure of this snake Apophis. And Apophis is a snake that exists in the netherworld that every evening threatens to destroy the sun god on his road to rebirth. And we have rituals that we believe probably would have been performed at midnight, at the sixth hour of night or the seventh hour of night, in these darkest times to help the sun god overcome it. So in the sixth hour of night, the hour when night is darkest, that's when the sun god, his soul joins with the body of Osiris, the deceased king. But the king who, even though he was deceased, was able to overcome death. So by the soul of the sun god descending and meeting with the corpse of Osiris, the sun god is able to gain access to his regenerative powers and be reborn. But when he emerges from that in hour 7 of the night, there's Apophis waiting for him. And we see that we actually would have had rituals, we think, enacted within the temple to help the sun god and his entourage defeat Apophis. And we have these examples and these remnants, in some cases, buried in the necropolis that show that they were performing these rituals, that they were creating vessels or dolls and then breaking them. So we've been talking a lot about destructive magic, but I don't want to give you the impression that that's all there was, or even that that's by far most of what they used in ancient Egypt. By far, most of ancient Egyptian magic was protective or apotropaic. And again, we can see that this makes sense from the psychology that we were talking about, the idea that this was meant to be a psychological balm, that this was meant to give the individuals living in ancient Egypt some sort of confidence that they had control over their life. So by far, what we see the most of are amulets, things that are meant to protect you against damage. And one of the reasons why we might imagine this is more popular is, let's go back and visit my fishing analogy, right? If I wear an amulet and nothing ever happens to me, which odds are nothing will happen to me anyways, if we just look at the law of averages, but let's say I have that to protect me in case of that, well, I'm going to think that that's 100% effective, that that was something that always worked because I never got bitten by that shark. I never got this disease. So we see what have to be millions of amulets being created. And the Egyptians used amulets along with papyrus and along with other spells that were meant to protect them. And that could be to protect them from a variety of different things and to act in a variety of different ways. In fact, the Egyptian word for amulet is sa'u, which means to guard or to protect. And individuals wore these during life and after death. So we have amulets not just for the living, but for the deceased, and many amulets that would go in between. And this is one of the great things about magic, at least one of the things that I think is great. I don't mean to say that magic works, because obviously it doesn't, but it's a logical system for those who use it. So for the ancient Egyptians, the shape of an object, the color, the material, the spell you set over it were all very important. They all gave it meaning. So I'll use one of the most common amulets that many of you, if you've ever seen an Egyptian amulet collection, would have seen, which is a waj amulet. This looks like a little pillar. They're usually green, and it stands for fertility or for new life. Well, the symbol that it has is waj. It's a papyrus column. That's usually how you'll see it. That word means flourishing. It means healthy. And waj itself is a color. We think blue-green type color. So this is something where it's green, it's flourishing, it's healthy. Individuals would wear this to help them to be green and fertile. Similarly, we see the ankh symbol. Most of you are familiar with that. It looks a bit kind of like a cross with a loop at the top. This is associated with life. And we can see these in many colors, although we'll often see them in black. And black in ancient Egypt was associated with Kemet, literally the black land, because it was that dark black soil that allowed life to be produced. So we see that these colors and these symbols all have meaning. And oftentimes it's associated with words and with a word that is linked to something else. A word like waj, that means healthy, that means flourishing. That's also the same root that we have for the wajet eye, the hole in the healthy eye, which you'll often hear also can be pronounced as the ujat eye. One of the more interesting, I think, bits of magic that are from this realm of protective magic are oracular decrees. These are things that are actually printed out on papyrus, and it's written in the form of a contract between an individual and the god, where the god promises to protect whoever wears the amulet against all evil. And where these are really fascinating is, in many cases, they'll list out many, many different things. And that's really interesting because it gives us a window into what these people feared. It will say something like, the god agrees and will protect you from the bite of a scorpion, the bite of a dog, the bite of a snake, the bite of a crocodile. It will list all of these things out. And then at the end, it usually ends with, and everything else I haven't said, which is, I think, a great, you know, kind of catch-all. These things we see, they could be rolled up, they could be placed in little tubes, or sometimes just the papyrus roll and then worn around their neck. And these were meant to protect individuals. We have other ones that come in the form of bracelets. Sometimes they'll have different images of gods written on them. Sometimes they'll just have text. And these things really are prolific. And what they tell us, especially by listing, for instance, many of the different charms against, say, snake bites or scorpion stings, is that there's more fear than there is actual danger. Think about it this way. I'm going to stick with my analogy of living in Los Angeles. We're a reclaimed desert. We've tried to push it back, but we do have areas where coyotes still go, where you can see rattlesnakes. And many of the images we see in ancient Egypt and many of these protective amulets and objects are a bit like everyone in Los Angeles wearing some sort of charm to protect them against a rattlesnake. Yeah, it's very possible someone living, you know, up in the hills, they might get bitten by a rattlesnake going on a hike. But how often does that happen? Even if it does, if it's somebody who's in relatively good health, probably are not going to die. But even nowadays, we do have anti-venom. They can go use that. But just to take my analogy to its logical conclusion, if we didn't, if the millions of people in LA are wearing that object, that's going to, again, give us some sort of comfort against a psychological fear that's not really real. But of course, we know a lot more about these things than they probably did, right? We know more about snakes, and they're not going to be as scary because we know these ones are poisonous, these ones aren't. Again, we have that psychological comfort that they maybe didn't. So the fact that most of the objects are meant to give them some sort of control, I think for the ancient world, very much makes sense. Now, let's change gears a little bit and talk about medicine. Medicine in ancient Egypt is very much tied to magic, as I said at the beginning. And what we see are that ancient Egyptian doctors, called sunu, actually begin, as they do today, with a diagnosis. They begin with an examination of what exactly is wrong. From there, they make the decision for what sort of treatment there's going to be. And we see that if for us, we were to list magic and medicine and religion as three separate things, which we probably would today, the ancient Egyptians saw them all as interrelated, and that practitioner could choose any sort of level or combination of those three to help for a cure. To return to the analogy of a broken arm that we discussed earlier. A broken arm, hey, we can set that. We don't need any magic. Or maybe we set that and we draw an Ankh on the arm sign to help it heal. Or we could set that, plus maybe you go make an offering to the god, and we're going to do a magic ritual to help speed the healing. We could mix and match any of those things. Now, for the ancient Egyptians, that type of thing, like a broken arm, would probably fall into a category that they could confidently deal with. Something that they knew, we can heal this. This is something that we know how to handle. As opposed to things they couldn't treat at all, say epilepsy. That's going to be the type of thing someone has seizures. They're not going to know anything to do with that. They may try to give them some herbs, but largely we're probably going to have a lot of medicine, a lot of religion coming into that. And then there are those things that they could actually are kind of in between, things that they felt they could fight. Maybe headaches, maybe indigestion, things that we've seen things that could work. We might be able to fight against it, even though they don't really have a good understanding of how it works. Now, as I mentioned before, lots of the amulets that we have and lots of the magic that we have has to do with keeping people healthy as opposed to helping them once they actually become sick. Of course, we do have extensive amount for sick, but not nearly as much as that protective. So when we're looking at how they actually treat some of these things, they go back to the concepts that we talked about earlier. That idea of, say, contagious magic or homeopathic magic, performative, right? The idea of magical causality we mentioned in the beginning still applies here. And to that extent, we see what for the Egyptians, again, makes sense. We see a lot of use of blood. We see a lot of use of excrement. Well, why are we using excrement? Why are we using, you know, poop and other types of feces? Well, for the Egyptians, that was something that was completely negative, completely antithetical to life. So by maybe using that, say putting it on a wound, you're hoping to draw out the bad, that maybe that's going to be attracted to its same and it's going to come out. At least this is one of the ideas that seems to be at play. And largely, we see that for the ancient Egyptians, religion, as magic and medicine pertain to it, have to do with these things that we can't cure, that they don't have any knowledge of. It's no surprise, I think, that in an agricultural society that's so dependent upon family and upon children, that fertility is one of the most important and one of the most prominent aspects of magic and medicine in daily life that we see. Interestingly enough, as many of you who are regular listeners of the podcast know, or who've listened to or read other things on ancient Egypt, in ancient Egypt, fertility was thought to lie with the man. So it was thought that the male had the productive seed. He had the power within him to create life. Creator gods are male. And so if your family can't have babies, that's not seen as something to do with the woman the way it is in most Western medieval and ancient societies. It's seen as being something wrong with the man. So we have tons and tons of evidence for, say, fertility enhancing. We see phalluses, of course, donated very, very commonly. Figurines that accentuate the breast and the pubic regions of women. We see different prayers, all sorts of things like that. We also see that some of the most important gods in the material record, gods like Beth and gods like Taweret, are associated with fertility and pregnancy and childbirth. These are things which the ancient Egyptians had very little control over, but were, of course, of paramount importance in everyday life. So these were all aspects of life where the ancient Egyptians really needed help. And so, in conclusion, you know, I'm sorry for those of you who were maybe hoping to hear a little bit more about the, say, Hermetica of Thoth, or to hear about particular ancient Egyptian spells. We can get into that on the podcast, and I think that will be fun to do at some point. But I wanted to really set the stage by explaining the psychology behind it, because I think it's important to realize this wasn't simply a system or a set of beliefs that belonged to some ancient group of backwards thinking people who were ridiculous. This is something that was very real, that provided a very real function. It was able to comfort them, and in many ways, no less of a comfort than many individuals today get by going to church and praying, or say by wearing a cross or a yarmulke. It's something that you can't prove that it works, but it helps to psychologically comfort you, and it's something that helps you to believe that you're living as you should and will be protected from those things that you cannot control. And in a way, maybe that's the centerpiece of attraction for most religions. As if we could wave a wand today and there's no idea of religion. It simply is a concept that does not exist. Life in many ways probably becomes very scary for a lot of people. a lot of the moral arguments that we might, you know, see today. Can you have morality outside of religion? I would probably argue yes, but this is the big question, right, for atheists. Not that I am one, but what extent does religion shape a society, either good or bad? What is the comfort that it gives to individuals? And those are the exact comforts that we get today from our religious experiences that the ancient Egyptians did. For them, their magical rituals were no less effective than the prayers of individuals today. Well, I think that's about it for this time. I hope that you enjoyed it. Don't worry, in future podcasts, we'll definitely explore some specific magical spells. We can get into how they worked. No doubt I'll do a specific podcast, say, just on the Book of the Dead, these funerary spells, and describe how those are and how they act. But for this time, this is Eric. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on, if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.